My name is Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. Thank you for joining us. On behalf of Senator Rockefeller and our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this program that focuses on a part of our changing healthcare system on which our most vulnerable populations depend, and that is safety net hospitals. These hospitals are one of the most important, but certainly not the only part of the safety net, and I just should say, as a footnote, we're going to be looking at community health centers and the rest of the safety net institutions later this summer in another briefing. Safety net hospitals provide care to those most in need of it at a time when employer-sponsored coverage is declining and the demand for safety net services in light of our economic situation has gone up dramatically, which, of course, means that states are facing severe fiscal pressures. They're having to squeeze Medicaid spending overall. We know that the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is going to offer some opportunities for safety net providers, assuming it survives its many challenges. But it would also present some significant challenges as well. Under that reform law, about 16 million additional people are anticipated to enroll in the Medicaid program, which, of course, is the single largest revenue source for most of these safety net hospitals. And also, under the law, beginning in 2014, there's scheduled to be a phased reduction in disproportionate share hospital funds, DSH payments, which is another stream of funding on which these hospitals rely greatly. Now, we're pleased to have as a partner in today's program the Commonwealth Fund, which has, particularly through its Commission on a High Performance Health System, done a great deal of work on how to help safety net hospitals cope with their short-term and their longer-term challenges. And we're very pleased to have as a co-moderator and an active participant in today's discussion, Dr. Pamela Riley, who's a pediatrician by training and a program officer in the Fund's Vulnerable Populations Program. Pam, thanks for being here, and let me turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Ed. So we're here today to really consider the importance of safety net hospitals, both to the patients that they serve and also to their communities as a whole. We'll hear today about many of the financial pressures that safety net hospitals face, both which threaten their current operations and which could potentially be made worse by changes that are coming under the Affordable Care Act. We'll further explore some of these issues and consider some policy options for perhaps using these limited funds that are available to safety net hospitals a little bit differently, a little bit more wisely, to sustain the operations of safety net hospitals, but also to encourage them to improve the way that they deliver care so that these hospitals will be around both now and after the Affordable Care Act is implemented to provide care to their patients and communities. I'll start by just giving a high-level overview of what the safety net is. There's generally no one accepted definition of what safety net providers are, but there are common traits that they have. It's basically a patchwork of healthcare providers that deliver a significant level of care to Medicaid, uninsured, and other vulnerable patients. And there's a wide variety of providers that meet these criteria. However, there's a subset of core safety net providers which provide a disproportionate share of care to these patients and which are also required by mission or by legal mandate to provide care to all patients regardless of their ability to pay. These core providers can include public hospitals and health systems. They also include community health centers, including federally qualified health centers and local health departments. And in many areas also includes academic medical centers, other community hospitals, and even private physicians. The focus of this briefing is on safety net hospitals in particular, just because the way in which they're funded and how their funding streams will change under the Affordable Care Act really creates a set of unique financial pressures that are different from those faced by community health centers and other safety net providers. It's important to recognize the role that safety net hospitals play, not just in terms of serving patients, but also for their communities as a whole. They provide their source of direct patient care, both inpatient care and primary care for these vulnerable populations that they serve. The primary care issue is particularly important given the shortage of providers that are willing to see Medicaid patients. And safety net hospitals are also frequently the only source of specialty care for Medicaid and uninsured patients in a particular area. They do provide other critical services to communities. For example, in many cases, safety net hospitals have the only trauma centers in their local areas, and they also provide other services like burn centers and patient psychiatric units that are traditionally unprofitable and frequently not provided by other hospitals. Safety net hospitals are also responsible for training the next generation of physicians and other healthcare providers. And in 2009, nearly a quarter of doctors who received training at acute care facilities nationwide were trained at safety net hospitals. And finally, it's important to remember that safety net hospitals are tremendous economic engines in their communities, and they make major contributions to both state and local economies and are frequently the largest employers in their regions. In terms of the populations that safety net hospitals served, as we know, they serve a disproportionate share of Medicaid and uninsured patients, as you can see from the data here from the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems. Medicaid and uninsured patients represented over half of the discharges from safety net hospitals in 2009, as compared to just over a quarter of hospitals nationally. The economic downturn has had a tremendous impact on the number of people who rely on safety net hospital services. As people have lost jobs, they've also lost their insurance coverage. Many of these patients are working poor whose employers either don't offer employer-sponsored insurance or who they can't afford the insurance coverage that their employers are offering. And many are underinsured, meaning that they actually have health insurance but cannot afford their medical expenses or their benefits are not comprehensive enough. The population served by the safety net also includes people who have recently lost jobs or in between jobs and have temporary gaps in their coverage. A recent Combo Fund study found that nearly 1 in 4 working-age adults experienced gaps in health insurance coverage ranging from 2 months to over 2 years, primarily because they changed or lost their jobs. So it's important to remember that the safety net serves these populations as well. Safety net hospitals are also an important source of care to immigrants, both legal and undocumented, who rely on the safety net. Legal immigrants are temporarily ineligible for Medicaid and must wait 5 years before being able to enroll if they are eligible. So they do rely on safety net hospitals for their care. And safety net hospitals also provide care to undocumented immigrants, although the proportion of care provided to undocumented varies quite considerably depending on the geographic location of the hospital. This is a little bit difficult to read, but I'll just refer you to your handouts. This is just a chart that sort of describes the disproportionate needs that this population experiences. They have tend to be very high-need, high-cost populations. They have higher incidence of poorly controlled chronic diseases, behavioral health issues, as well as personal and social and financial factors that can cause problems and cause health problems and also impede access to care. And safety net hospitals in particular must be equipped to deal with these problems by providing services such as social services, other support services like transportation, translation, financial or housing assistance. And these services tend to not be very profitable, but they're just as essential to providing care for these populations as is providing health care. The Affordable Care Act is expected to have a variety of implications for safety net hospitals, but today we'll focus on how it will change the way safety net hospitals are funded. As we know, safety net hospitals are under current financial pressures imposed by the increased demand for their services combined with their shrinking budgets. And with an estimated 16 million people acquiring Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, there's potential for hospitals to gain more revenue by seeing more insured patients. However, there are many factors in play which will affect whether or not that actually translates into actual gains, including factors affecting which populations actually enroll in Medicaid and how this enrollment will affect the hospital's payer mix. The Affordable Care Act also includes cuts in disproportionate share hospital payments, which are Medicaid supplemental payments, which help cover the added costs of caring for Medicaid and uninsured patients. And hospitals rely heavily on these DSH payments to cover the costs of uncompensated care. And there's a concern among many safety net hospitals that these potential increased gains from Medicaid will not be enough to offset the losses that they'll experience with the cuts in DSH payments. And this, you know, is a situation that could really threaten the care that they're able to provide to the patients who need it the most. It's also important to remember that even though the Affordable Care Act will expand coverage for many, there will still be an estimated 26 million people who remain uninsured. So safety net hospitals will still very much be needed after health reform is implemented to take care of the remaining uninsured, but also, you know, to serve as a willing provider for this expanded Medicaid population, and also really to best meet the health and social needs facing this particular population. So we really need to be concerned about what happens if safety net hospitals collapse, or as many of them have folded. These patients who are extremely vulnerable would be left more vulnerable to poor health and poor health care access. And we also have to think about the burden on other providers, non-safety net hospitals, who, if safety net hospitals fold, would be faced with the burden of caring for these very high-need, high-cost patients and may not be as well equipped to do so. So our panelists today will help us to further explore a lot of these issues. Their complete bios are in your packets. I encourage you to read them, but I'll briefly introduce them. Our first speaker is Deborah Bachrach. She is special counsel for healthcare transaction policy with Manatt, Phelps & Phillips in New York City. And she is actually the author of the recent report, the Commonwealth Fund Commission on High Performance Health Systems report, focused on sustainable funding for safety net hospitals. You do have the executive summary of the report in your packets, and the full report is available on the Commonwealth Fund website. So she will discuss some of the policy recommendations from this report on how to better target these limited existing funds to hospitals serving populations with the greatest levels of need. Deborah will be followed by Billy Milwee, who is the Medicaid director for the state of Texas, and he will give us some more insight as to how he is approaching these changes from the Medicaid perspective. He will be followed by Art Gianelli, who is president of the New Health System, a major public hospital system in East Meadow, New York. And he'll shed light on how these current financial pressures facing safety net hospitals play out on the ground and how his system is preparing for and already dealing with some of the effects of the Affordable Care Act. And our final speaker will be Patrick Conway, who is the Chief Medical Officer with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and he will give us the perspective of the administration on some of the challenges of implementing some of these provisions that are expected to have an impact on how safety net systems are financed. So with that, I will turn it to Deborah.
No, you won't. Well, eventually. I just wanted to do a little housekeeping, if I could. As Pam alluded to, you'll find not just the Commonwealth executive summary of the report, but also a number of other background pieces that you might find useful, and a list of additional material that you can use to get the next steps in your education. Tomorrow there will be a webcast available of this briefing. Compliments of the Kaiser Family Foundation, available both through their website, kff.org, and the alliances at allhealth.org. There'll be a transcript that we will have on our website within a week or so. At the appropriate time, I want you to feel free to fill out a question at the green, on the green question card. There are also microphones that you can use to ask a question orally. And take note of the blue evaluation form in your packets, because we'd very much appreciate your filling that out before you leave so that we can improve these briefings and target them to your needs. So we're ready for a great discussion. And with the clicker in Deborah's hands, we're ready for Deborah Bachrach.
So I'm going to race through the first. I'm going to race through the first few slides because they focus on the characteristics of safety net hospitals. And Pam has really done a great job of that. So takeaways, just safety net hospitals serve especially large numbers of Medicaid and uninsured, relatively fewer privately insured patients, an important factor as well, limited reserves, low operating margins, but there's no bright line. It's not like at 25% Medicaid discharges or more, your safety net, below 25, you're not. It's along a continuum, and that's another important point to keep, bear in mind. So the next three graphs make the following point. This one, if you can see it at all, says that as Medicaid revenue goes up, commercial and Medicare revenue go down, but commercial revenue goes down more quickly. And I'm happy that Art's nodding his head in agreement. And don't look at far to the right because we don't have enough hospitals in our sample. This one says to you that there are a relatively small number of hospitals that are serving a relatively high number of Medicaid patients. And this one says, while that is true, many Medicaid patients receive care at hospitals that do not have high Medicaid mix. So if you move on now, let's talk about the core revenue streams for safety net hospitals. And I want to focus on two today, Medicaid and Medicaid disproportionate share hospital payments, DSH payments. And these two, if we're going to have high-quality, cost-effective care provided by our safety net hospitals, we have to take a hard look at our Medicaid and DSH payment policies. Medicaid is the largest payer for our safety net hospitals. Medicaid rates tend to be low, lower than commercial payers, lower than Medicare. They're getting lower. Now, that's not every state and it's not every service, but as a general proposition, that's true. And the incentives, and we'll come back to this, are often completely irrational. By that, I mean encouraging inpatient care over for outpatient care and the like. DSH payments, Medicaid DSH payments, are intended to cover the uncompensated care burdens of disproportionate share hospitals, of your high-volume Medicaid uninsured hospitals. But in many states, perhaps most, they're not particularly well-targeted to safety net hospitals. And on top of that, as both Pam and Ed said, the ACA, starting in 2014, is going to reduce DSH payments, Medicaid DSH payments, significantly, based on the theory and hopefully the reality that many more people will be insured and we will have far fewer uninsured. So now let's look at Medicaid payment policies. Because quite frankly, if we don't get this right, we aren't going to have a sustainable safety net delivery system. So when we think about how do we want to target Medicaid payment, where do safety net hospitals fit into Medicaid payment policies. The report suggests, and this came about with a lot of discussion with the commissioners, but we laid out three goals, and it starts with, but it does not end with, sustaining safety net hospitals, because we go on to say we want to support the delivery system reform at these hospitals in order to ensure that Medicaid patients have access to high-quality, coordinated and efficient care. I'm going to stop and tell you a little story about myself. For many, many, many years before I became New York's Medicaid director, I represented Medicaid-dependent providers, including safety net hospitals. And I would go to our state capitol and I would lobby to get more money for safety net hospitals. Just give them more money. They need it. They're the good guys. Over time, and partly why I became Medicaid director, I realized that just give safety net hospitals more money was not the answer. And I'm now big into transparency and accountability and sustaining safety net hospitals. So hence the three overarching goals. So what's the landscape today? We've all told it to you. And it's not like we needed to tell it to you. federal and state budget deficits are putting pressure on Medicaid payment rates, makes it almost impossible to talk about across-the-board increases to Medicaid. Even if you're in a state where we know Medicaid rates are too low, and the answer is if they're too low, raise them, it isn't possible. So that's what brings us to thinking about strategically investing in Medicaid rates. It also means that we can talk about what's the method of payment. Is it rational? Is it transparent? Is there a level of accountability? And we should remember that just 2 weeks ago, CMCS came out with draft regulations on the primary care bump, which indirectly benefits hospitals by providing increased Medicaid payments to primary care physicians when they deliver primary care services. So let's talk about strategic investment in Medicaid rates. First, and I've really talked about all of this, what's our first challenge? And that's to identify the hospitals, the services, and the settings in which we want to invest. What's the safety net hospital? How do we want to invest? In what setting? Inpatient versus outpatient? Both? What about what services? Which are the services to which Medicaid patients need access? So it's not just hand over the money. And then we want to think about it in terms of transparency and accountability. How do we target to hospitals with higher Medicaid volume and lower commercial volume? How do we link the payment to performance, ensuring transparency and accountability, the theme of the day, and avoid lump sum payments? And I keep thinking about what many states do and what New York did, which is we took our Medicaid increases and we simply said it's $1,000 a discharge. Whether it's an appendectomy or a heart transplant, you get $1,000. Well, what's the incentive with that? There's one state, and we discuss it in, I'm sure it's in this paper, it's another paper I wrote, which says it's $1,000 a discharge. Actually, it's $3,000 a discharge, and the hospital's entitled to it even if it was a potentially preventable readmission for which the underlying Medicaid payment is not being made. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So hence the avoid lump sum payments as we invest in Medicaid payment policies. So again, incentivize care in the right setting. In my personal experience, we had lots of add-ons to inpatient rates so that it was far more lucrative to admit a patient than to treat them on the outpatient side because there were all those payments attached to that discharge. And then target needed services with limited access. Mississippi did this by increasing their inpatient rates for behavioral health. They simply needed more access to psych beds. And I bet Art will talk about this as well, but we need to think about where do Medicaid patients need access and not just increase payments. And then finally, and I think Billy will come to this, when we think about our strategies, we need to crosswalk from fee-for-service to managed care as we start to see more and more states embracing a managed care delivery model as well as an ACO delivery model. So there's a lot of reason to start with fee-for-service, and there's a lot of reason not to end with fee-for-service. I want to move now to Medicaid DSH payments, and this is my setup slide. Now, I could easily do an entire deck on Medicaid DSH payments. So I tried to think through what are the few features that I wanted to call out that were most relevant to the next slide, which is how do we better target Medicaid DSH payments? So really, here's a flyover on some very complicated laws and policies. So, since 1987, federal law requires states to make Medicaid DSH payments to hospitals with a high volume of Medicaid and uninsured discharges. But the state has complete discretion on how to allocate those dollars and can allocate them to hospitals with very little Medicaid and uninsured volume, so long as it also embraces or includes in the allocation your high-volume Medicaid hospital. While the state has significant flexibility, there are two overarching constraints. One is the state has a dish cap, so the state may only receive federal matching dollars, because remember it's Medicaid, for a certain amount of money. So that's the state dish cap. And there's also a hospital-specific dish cap that is tied to that hospital's costs, uncompensated care costs, for serving Medicaid and uninsured patients. And there's earlier this year, new guidance came out on calculating uncompensated care costs for hospital-specific dish cap. An important clarification was uninsured means uninsured for the service that you need. So you could be insured, but you don't have coverage for behavioral health. So you are then uninsured, and those costs can go into the hospital's calculation. So bad debt doesn't count. If I don't pay my copays or deductibles, that is not uncompensated care. And this is all very important, and I'm sure Art will talk more about it, because this is the limit on how much any one hospital can receive. Now, it's not on my slide, but I can't help say something about provider taxes, because they're always in the news, including last week. So my personal view is there's nothing wrong with provider taxes. Provider taxes are used to pay, in some directly or indirectly, the state's share, the non-federal share, of the DSH payment. So in theory, there's nothing wrong with it. Here's what I hate about provider taxes. In order to get them through the legislature, you often have to get the hospital's buy-in. And when the only way to get the hospital's buy-in is if they get the money back. So to the extent Medicaid DSH is intended to go to safety net hospitals for the cost of uncompensated care, and the quid pro quo for getting the tax was an allocation formula that sent it to hospitals that have relatively few Medicaid and uninsured to compensate them for the tax, that's the problem. So I'm hoping we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And then finally, as we've all said, the ACA reduces Medicaid DSH, and that's a big issue that I'm going to come back to. I want to do it on this slide. So let's talk a little bit about what the ACA says. The ACA says to the Secretary, I'm almost done, I promise you. You have to reduce your DSH, but you have to reduce it to states. Your largest DSH reduction goes to states with the lowest uninsured, lowest levels of uncompensated care, and those that don't target Medicaid and uninsured patients, which is an incentive to start targeting now. Okay, last one, and I'm going to do this in less than a minute, I promise, Ed, is, okay, so if we want to talk about better targeting Medicaid DSH payments, here's what the report says, and here's what I want to throw out to you for consideration. First and foremost, it ought to be targeted to the hospitals that are still seeing those 26 million people that will remain uninsured. And over 20, so I'm now, Commonwealth's updated 26. And I would argue that it should go out based on services rendered to a particular uninsured patient. I know, and I'm looking at Leighton Koo, who will tell me, it's hard for hospitals to get that data. But for God's sakes, you can figure out, I'm on United, let's figure out who's uninsured, let's pay it out based on a unit of service rendered to an uninsured patient, and let's base it on some small discount off of the Medicaid rate. Because if you took my first recommendation, the Medicaid rate has gone up. That should be the first priority. Second priority, the underinsured. I raised the question, who do we consider underinsured post-2014? And the third priority, which is how DSH payments are used now, which I would suggest we ought to be rethinking, is to cover the difference between Medicaid costs and a particular hospital's Medicaid revenue. Hospital-specific costs, we're moving away from that. Hospital-specific revenue, is that really a criteria. And finally, I want to say that as we cut Medicaid DSH payments, let's think about using the state dollars and reinvesting in the Medicaid rates of safety net hospitals. Thank you. Billy's next. Sorry.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be with you today. And thank you to the Alliance and the Commonwealth Fund for hosting the discussion today. I'm Billy Milway. I'm with the Texas Medicaid Program. I want to talk to you today about the Texas Healthcare Transformation and Quality Improvement Program waiver. But before I get into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about upper payment limit, or UPL. UPL goes hand-in-hand with DSH in providing supplemental payments for the safety net hospitals. UPL was actually the catalyst for our waiver. Let me define UPL. And UPL, at its very simplistic level, is this. It allows a hospital to claim the difference between what Medicaid paid and what Medicare would have paid, and is an important funding stream for safety net hospitals. In Texas, that accounts for about $2.8 billion every year in payments to our safety net and other hospitals. This slide kind of represents the hospitals in Texas, of which we have 531, the majority of which participate in the Medicaid program and provide services to our 3.5 million Medicaid recipients. Of that number, 122 are public hospitals, 154 are not-for-profits, and 255 are for-profits. And as Pamela and Deborah pointed out, it's hard to tell which one is really a safety net. You really have to dive into what services they provide and who they serve. Largely, the publics and not-for-profits are, but we also have the for-profits to provide services in our safety net programs. There are some problems, though, with UPL, and here are the problems. UPL inhibits efficiency in your delivery system. There are prohibitions on states implementing managed care because you take a decrease in your UPL to this very important source of funds for the safety net. Managed care days can't count towards that UPL calculation. So it creates some disincentives. For example, in 2005, we expanded managed care, our initial early-on expansion, and the model that we expanded was, we refer to it as STAR Plus. STAR Plus provides, it's an integrated acute care and long-term care model that serves largely the age-blind and disabled. We actually carved inpatient services out of managed care in order to preserve UPL. Now, that wasn't done to make the system more efficient. It wasn't done because it was a really good idea. It was done because we had to preserve UPL. Fast forward to 2011, we're facing some budget pressures, and we need to expand managed care yet again, this time to South Texas and also to the rural areas of the state, and also, again, STAR Plus, so we can care for the age-blind and disabled in a more efficient way. Well, that would have not only improved the delivery services to that population, but saved the state $395 million in general revenue, saved the federal government about $500 million in funds, but that expansion with UPL would have cost the hospitals in our communities $2.8 billion. So that was the catalyst for the waiver, is preservation of that federal funding stream because of the safety net's reliance upon it. There were some other issues around UPL that is associated with it's not a payment for a service. It's a payment, and I cannot tell you what that $2.8 billion that we spend every year is really purchasing, because it's a matter of providing the match to draw down those dollars, not really a level of quality or anything else that I can really attach to and tell you that was a value purchase. So that was the context for the waiver. The waiver at a high level is based upon three primary components: regional health partnerships, funding pools, and regional health partnership plans. The regional health partnerships are locally developed. I call them confederations because it's a group of people who come together that are not mandated by law. They come together to develop these regional health plans. The plans identify strategies to address uncompensated care and delivery system reform. The participants in the partnership include county medical associations, community mental health centers, public and private hospitals, other local government partners, academic health science centers, our public health directors, and consumers and advocates. In the past, when you talk about UPL, it was usually a conversation between the Medicaid program and the CFO of a hospital. Now you have a community of people that come together to talk about how they're going to use this partnership to leverage funding. The plans developed by the regional health partnerships address payment for uncompensated care and identify delivery system reform projects. For each delivery system reform project, metrics are established that later drive payments. We formed our partnerships, and let's see, was that there? Was that on the last one? This map kind of identifies our partnerships. We have formed 20. Any one of these partnerships is rather large. Some of them large as the state, either in geography or population size. There are funding pools. Those funding pools are formed by the savings from managed care expansion and also the previous UPL program. UPL no longer exists in Texas today, but rather we have the funding pools. There are two funding pools available within the waiver, uncompensated care and these delivery system reform incentive payments. I'll refer to them as DSRIP. The public entities within the partnership provide the state match for either uncompensated care or district projects, and payments associated with uncompensated care are limited to actual costs. That's important because in the old UPL days, a hospital could claim cost up to charges. So UPL in many ways puts inflationary pressure on our whole healthcare economy. Each of these regional health plans and the regional health partnerships and develops their plan, and the plan identifies all those payments and the source of the state match. The DSRIP projects are selected from a menu that we have developed with the partnerships, with the Academic Health Science Center, and also with consumer input. There are some components of the menu that we mandate that each partnership address. For instance, diabetes, infant mortality, and access to mental health services, each of these 20 partnerships must address. For others, there's a local option. It becomes very much of a community-driven experience in participating in these partnerships. And actually what is happening as we have developed these regional partnerships, you're seeing community systems of care develop. Conversations are happening now that have not happened in the past, when you have actually competing hospitals sitting down at the same table to talk to maybe a public health director that none of them really knew, are talking to the community mental health center that previously was not engaged in any of their business. It provides some real opportunities for integrated care and collaboration. From the menu, they select, we have four categories. Category one is infrastructure development. That may be expanding access to primary care or expanding access to mental health services. Program innovation and redesign, we've tried to frame those around the potentially preventable events, readmissions, primary care, preventable admissions, preventable use of the emergency department, and quality improvements. These are clinical considerations, things like prevention of central line infections, reducing hospitalization for a number of causes, and then population-based improvements. Something else that we have done is taken these items that these regional health partnerships are working on, and we've baked them into our HMO rates. And here's what I mean by that. We have 18 HMOs within the state operating in our managed care expansion. 5% of the HMO premium is at risk, and that risk is tied to performance on those same things that the regional health partnerships are working on. And what we're trying to do is create the synergy between our Medicaid HMOs and what our public hospitals and safety net are working on to drive the performance improvement. Where we're at in implementation, we have formed our partnerships. May 25th, we had our final hearing. We formed the partnerships, and now we're negotiating the final district menu and the funding protocols and those kind of things with CMS, and we'll be standing up the program the 1st of September. Thank you very much.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Arthur Gianelli. I'm the president and CEO of the New Health System. It's a public benefit corporation that runs a public hospital, a public nursing home, and co-operates a federally qualified health center. Before I start, I just wanted to thank Ed Howard from the Alliance and Pam Riley from the Commonwealth Fund for the invitation, and to acknowledge the other panelists here today as well for the really striking and very, very interesting contributions. And I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy day for coming. I'm going to give you a ground floor perspective. We've had sort of the upper floors talk, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on the ground. And the first thing that I think is important to say is that though there is a larger discussion that's going on about what's going to happen to the Affordable Care Act if the Supreme Court rules again that the individual mandate is unconstitutional, The reality is that at least on the innovation side, at least on the side where we're talking about how to reform and change the delivery system from one that pays for volume to one that pays for and incentivizes value, that train has left the station. All right, those changes are fundamental. They're absolute. They're occurring all across the United States. You just heard some very, very interesting examples from the state of Texas. Deborah, who was the Medicaid director several years ago, was frankly ahead of the curve and really quite progressive on this front as well. It's happening all over the United States. And the reality is we as providers are having to adjust and change how we do business in order to accommodate these change, what's going on. So reform is here. The reality is that government at all level is resource starved, and there's pressure on the entire healthcare delivery system to reduce cost and simultaneously improve quality. So you've got payers at all levels that are pushing hospitals to bend the cost curve through improvements and by driving care to ambulatory settings. And these payers are incentivizing improvement efforts through a number of different strategies, accountable care organizations, bundled payments, health homes, and other risk-based strategies. The bottom line is that, again, the payers are moving from simply paying for fee-for-service to paying for some kind of value delivered for the payments that they are providing. So what are hospitals doing in response to these changes that are going on? Well, they're doing a number of different things. Hospitals are actually engaging right now in reducing unnecessary admissions in a whole host of ways, whether it's partnering for care management services, whether it's focusing on those patients with high probabilities of readmission, whatever it is. And what's very, very interesting, and I'm borrowing a phrase from the advisory board, is that hospitals are in an economy where they are effectively being asked to do something that's against their nature, which is to destroy their own demand. Hospitals are being asked to play a critical role in the reform of the healthcare delivery system precisely by preventing admissions that are preventable. You almost can't find another example in any other sector of an economy where a major economic player is asked to do less of what they do. But that's precisely what's going on in healthcare, and it's critically important, by the way, that hospitals succeed in doing this for the healthcare system to be sustainable in the long term. Hospitals are expanding their primary care and care management reach. They're developing alignment strategies with physicians. They're integrating with other hospitals and with insurance plans. They're seeking capital where they can, and in sometimes some very unusual places, including from for-profit investors or even private equity firms. And they're entering into quality-driven risk and shared savings contracts with payers. Now, we talked about what a safety net provider is. I don't need to get into that. But again, safety net providers, high degree of Medicaid and uninsured, and a special focus on taking care of the most vulnerable patients in a community. And that vulnerability can be payer-independent. Vulnerability can be mental health. Disease vulnerability can be frail elderly, et cetera. But I'm going to speak as an executive from a public hospital and talk a little bit about what public hospitals do in the United States. And again, I borrow this from the National Association of Public Hospitals, and we have a few representatives from the association here today. National Association of Public Hospital members provide 31% of their ambulatory care visits and 18% of their inpatient services to uninsured patients. Uncompensated care represents 16% of NAPH total member costs. It's 6% for all other hospitals. And NAPH members provide 20% of the total uncompensated acute care in the United States, but they represent just 2% of the acute care hospitals in the United States. NAPH members provide 45 million non-emergency outpatient visits, and the average NAPH member provides more than five times the volume of non-emergency visits, outpatient visits, as other U.S. acute care hospitals. As Deborah had indicated earlier, the payer mix is heavily weighted toward the government payers. The average NAPH hospital has 27% Medicaid, 26% Medicare, 24% commercial, 19% uninsured, and 4% other. That's on the inpatient side. On the outpatient side, you would likely see more uninsured and more Medicaid. You certainly would see that at our hospital. And the source of financing for uncompensated care is really reliant heavily on two sources, state and local subsidization, but really Medicaid and Medicare disproportionate share payments. Now, I use this chart, which is a chart that's provided by the American Hospital Association, to really drive home the point that the more heavily weighted a hospital is toward governmental payers, Medicaid and Medicare payers, the tighter its margins are going to be. Because the reality is, and most many of you know this, but this chart, I think, emphasizes the point that that hospitals have gone to the commercial payers in order to cross-subsidize losses that they incur in taking care of Medicaid beneficiaries or those who are enrolled in Medicare. And as we progress into the Affordable Care Act, as more and more patients in some states are enrolled in Medicaid, and where there is downward pressure on the part of state departments of insurance, for example, in regulating increases in commercial premiums, you're going to see a true tightening of the resources that are available to hospitals, and certainly a tightening of the resources that are going to be available to public hospitals and safety net facilities. It's also important to note that though it's a pretty much an even split nationally between the projected increase in commercial enrollment due to the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid enrollment due to the Affordable Care Act, that differs state by state. So if you take a state like New York, because New York has expanded its Medicaid enrollment over the years, the Affordable Care Act really will have an impact on the commercial side, not so much on the Medicaid side. Other states are differently positioned, but it's an important point to note that that slide is not uniform across each and every state. Now, what I thought I would do is try to give you a sense, you know, as folks who are working for policymakers, I wanted to give you a sense of those strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and threats that are that characterize public hospitals as they are approaching reform. And it's important to know that there are certain strengths that public hospitals have. Most public hospitals have a much higher degree of employed physicians than community hospitals or other sorts of hospitals. That's important for alignment purposes. That's important to ensure that hospitals and physicians are working in coordination in order to achieve quality and reduce unnecessary utilization. Public hospitals have extensive primary care networks. Many are integrated care delivery systems, and they have a lot of experience working on limited resources. So we know that game. We've been doing it for a long time, and we know we're going to continue to do it. Now, weaknesses, of course, is that there's a flip side. The reality is that they have been working on thin or negative operating margins for years, and as a result, are undercapitalized organizationally, and that makes it difficult to make the investments that are necessary to make the transition from volume to value payments. Governmentally appointed boards means you can have an interesting cast of characters on your board, or you can have transitions in your board particularly difficult or challenging times. Public hospitals have limited organizational flexibility, high cost structure, and a difficulty accessing capital. But now there are opportunities and there are threats, and I do want to focus on the opportunities. And certainly one which I actually didn't put here, which I do want to note, is clearly to the extent that the Affordable Care Act goes through and survives Supreme Court challenge, the reality is that there will be more patients who will be insured, and that will help across the board and will certainly help public hospitals. But public hospitals will have an opportunity to expand the current outpatient and primary care capacity, leverage their physician alignment to drive quality and utilization management, use their integrated systems to participate in accountable payment opportunities, partner with states to manage the dual eligible population. I think this is a huge opportunity for public hospitals. These are high-cost drivers, highly needy population that public hospitals, I think, are uniquely situated to be able to try to make improvements in. Obtain Section 1115 waivers geared toward delivery system redesign. California is an excellent example, the Bridges to Reform waiver. And I would note as well, and this is something that we're doing in New York, and that is that states have the capacity to confer state action antitrust protection on a variety of unique collaborative relationships amongst providers if they conclude that the collaboration, even if though it's reducing competition, inures to the public benefit. And that's a very, very powerful tool, and I think it's a tool that could be used state by state in order to help to protect important collaborative relationships amongst public providers, safety net providers, and maybe more financially well-endowed providers. But there are threats. The Supreme Court decision, either way, you still have to deal with the exchanges and who is insured and who's not. Disproportionate share payment reductions and adverse selection to the extent that the Supreme Court decision is adverse and declares the mandate unconstitutional. There's an incongruence between the integration imperatives in the law and the current stark antitrust and anti-kickback laws. That has to be resolved, and we have to make a choice at a policy level which way we want to go. Organizational structures, again, provide limitations. Accountable care and population management business models haven't been proven out yet. And there's ongoing downward pressure on payers. And let me just conclude here in terms of how policymakers can help. And just very quickly, and I think, you know, sort of echoing what Deborah indicated, but I would even broaden it. You've got limited Medicaid dollars and you've got limited disproportionate share dollars. So I think from a policy perspective, we've got to think about focus. We've got to think about how to focus those dollars to do the maximum amount of good in terms of quality, in terms of access, in terms of accountability, and in terms of transparency. And what's needed is for the public hospitals to step up and say, you know what, we'll take that trade-off. We'll take the trade-off of focus. Of that focus in exchange for our performance. And I think that's something that public hospitals would be willing to do, because the reality is we don't have enough Medicaid dollars to spread around the entire system. If they're focused, they can do a heck of a lot more for the patients that are enrolled. The Section 1115 waiver program is a hugely important program to try to catalyze reform efforts at a state level. States and local governments can provide public hospitals with greater organizational flexibility to get disencumbered from those legacies that, frankly, are costly and don't add value. We need to clear up the antitrust concerns. And, again, the utilization of state action antitrust protection, I think, provides unique and important opportunities for public hospitals and other providers to collaborate in a non-owned capacity. And finally, and I would encourage this amongst policymakers at all levels, is let's not keep changing the rules. It's very, very challenging as a provider to have the rules constantly changed for what you need to do. Let me leave quickly with this story. I was in a meeting the other day talking about a decline in our volume. And in the discussion that we were having, it was clear that my emergency department was actually reducing admissions to the hospital based upon the tenor of discussions that I've had about unnecessary admissions. And what I told them is, I said, look, the reality is we live in a world right now where we're in two boats. We're still a little bit in that fee-for-service boat, but we're kind of leaning into the accountable care and the value boat. But we're not quite there yet. And so the reality is we as providers have to do everything right to try to prevent somebody from coming to the hospital. Primary care, care management, medicine reconciliation, everything that we need to do. But it is still the case that until the payment structure fully changes over, that we have to, when somebody comes to our hospital, if there's an argument to be made for their admission, we have to admit them because we have to get paid. What I would encourage, though, is that disconnect, that incongruity, we need to move sooner than later away from. And we as a nation and as a state and as a provider are then all moving in one direction. We're in one boat, rowing together in order to be able to improve the delivery system and reduce our costs and ultimately save our healthcare system. Thank you.
But just don't do it and change the rules continuously. And that leads us to Dr. Patrick Kemp Conway.
OK.
Can we have the clicker?
Okay. Yeah, thank you for having me here today. So I'm Patrick Conway, Chief Medical Officer of CMS and Director of the Office of Clinical Standards and Quality. I want to thank the Alliance and the Commonwealth Fund for having us. I should note I trained and practiced in a number of safety net hospitals, including Bentaub in Texas at one point. And I currently work weekends as a pediatric hospital medicine attending in an institution that serves a large percentage of Medicaid and low-income families. I am Chief Medical Officer for CMS. That's broader than just Medicare. So it includes Medicaid and CHIP and the exchanges now as well. And we work very closely with our Medicaid and duals office colleagues. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say how much of this work I'm talking about is led by our Medicaid, our duals office, CMMI, and others across CMS. So I'm going to talk briefly today about some health transformation changes that we're making and then tie it back to the safety net as well. First, on quality improvement, second, on payment models, third, regulation, and then four, as was alluded to, access to insurance coverage. We have a common goal here. It's better health, better care, and lower cost. I've practiced in systems and led QI transformation of systems focused on those three goals. It is achievable. You have tremendous safety net hospital examples of achieving those three goals. So the question now really is, how do we foster that transformation broadly across the safety net? So in terms of quality improvement funding, we have our quality improvement organization funding. We are now focused much more on learning and action networks, getting networks of collaborative QI across states and in localities, and I think and a much larger focus on population health, safety, readmissions, and safety in the hospital. I should note there's no corollary steady funding stream for Medicaid and CHIP like the QIO program. Second, in terms of partnership for patients, we're funding over $500 million through the Innovation Center focused on hospital safety and readmissions, have hospital engagement networks that literally cover the country, engaging now with I think we'd have to check with our Innovation Center colleagues, but I think we're about up to 4,500 hospitals, so almost every hospital in America. This is a very different paradigm for CMS to fund this kind of work. The third program I'll mention is community care transitions, so funding up to $500 million in communities across this country, focusing on readmissions and funding community-based organizations, realizing that readmissions is a complex phenomenon that really involves a whole community, is not just a hospital issue. Next, I want to talk about payment models. Some of this was alluded to already. With accountable care organizations, whether it's Shared Savings Program or our Pioneer ACO program, I think this is an opportunity for safety net hospitals and safety net providers, and we've seen people come to the table. Safety net providers have a history of thinking about population health. You know, it also goes into some of our managed care work, which very much aligns with how safety net providers thinking about managing populations of patients. Second, I'll mention hospital value-based purchasing. This program, we were given the flexibility by Congress to reward both improvement or attainment. So we have safety net providers with very high performance, and we're able to reward that. We also have safety net providers that maybe have struggled on some of the measures, and we can reward them for improvement. So when we have that flexibility, it aids us in our programs. I'd mentioned the Medicaid medical home work and other primary care model work. I think a tremendous focus on safety net providers and enabling you to be successful. We do, in some programs, our readmissions program, which was alluded to. There's less flexibility in the statute, so we're using NQF-endorsed measures. It's all payment adjustment negative, and we don't have an opportunity to reward improvement. However, I'd say the overall focus on how do we decrease readmissions, how do we think about population health is on target, and now I think our challenge as an agency is to execute in a way that we don't create unintended negative consequences for safety net providers and the patients that you serve. Lastly, in CMMI, our Innovation Center, funding a number of programs. Certainly, they're focused on broad health system transformation, but I'd note that we often have safety net providers and hospitals that apply and are awarded grants. Denver Health, as an example, was just rewarded one of the Innovation Challenge Awards. Next, I'll talk about regulations and some of the work we're doing to try to help safety net hospitals. In May 2000, this also comes out of my office. In May 2011, we streamlined the credentialing and process to enable telemedicine for rural health and critical access hospitals. This was critical, no pun intended, in terms of enabling telemedicine in those areas. And then just last month, we released the largest overhaul of the hospital conditions of participation in the agency's history. So we removed over $1 billion of unnecessary regulations from hospital conditions of participation. Much of it focused on flexibility to different providers, and this would include safety net providers, on how you provide care, and also removing things like a separate nursing care plan for anyone who's worked in the hospital. It actually makes no sense when we're trying to integrate care to have regulations that actually disintegrate care. So we were providing the flexibility so you can take care of the populations that you serve. I'm actually going to end up finishing early, so we'll get back. And then the last area, which I won't spend a lot of time on because others already have, you know, we at the agency view the Medicaid expansion and the healthcare exchanges as an opportunity to increase access to health insurance in this country. Access to health insurance doesn't complete the transformation cycle of better health, better care, and lower cost, but it's a critical step along that pathway. So we really view this as an opportunity to achieve that three-part aim of better health, better care, and lower cost, to making sure that people have access to the insurance coverage that they need. I think lastly, I'll end where I started. Healthcare transformation is deeply personal to me. I am still a practicing physician. As I mentioned, in all my stops, I've actually practiced in safety net providers as part of my work. I think the work that safety net hospitals do is incredibly important. I think you serve some of the most vulnerable populations of this country, and I think CMS is an agency. We need to work with you to make sure that you're able to serve those populations and we achieve what we want for our nation, so achieve that better health, better care at a lower cost through continuous improvement. So thank you, those of you here from the Hill and from safety net providers and others. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thanks very much, Dr. Conway and the other panelists. Now we get you into this conversation. We offer you the opportunity to ask your question directly. As I said, there are green cards in your packets that you can use to write the question down. If you do use the microphones, we'd ask you to identify yourself and keep it as brief as you possibly can. Pam, you should feel free to interrupt me at any time as well. One of the questions that occurred to me as I heard a couple of the presentations was the emphasis on outpatient care, the need to reduce unnecessary readmissions and admissions. What does that do to the capital expansion plans that people have in mind? And Art, you referred to that specifically.
Well, that's a great question, and you know what I struggle with is the fact that if I look at my hospital in the cold objective reality and cold objective light of reality, in 5 or 10 years, assuming the Affordable Care Act moves along the path that I think is going to move, and assuming reform moves along the path that I think is going to move, I will have a much smaller inpatient hospital in a 19-story building. I will need to have capital to make investment in primary care facilities because there will be I will need a lot more primary care capacity to do the work that's required, and I'm going to have to figure out what to do with parts of a building that frankly are no longer necessary because my primary care really should not be in the hospital. It should be out in the community. So these are significant capital challenges, which is why I think one of the ways in which policymakers can help is to provide access to safety net facilities to capital, but target the capital for these kinds of transformations. This is something that New York State is doing, and I think they're doing it quite smartly, and it sounds like Texas is doing that as well, California is doing that, and I think it's a pattern that we should see throughout the United States, because the reality is I could not affect that transformation without the access to capital to do it, but it's a necessary transformation to really accommodate the imperatives of reform.
Yes, right ahead.
Stephanie Pincus, Institute of Medicine. Concurrent with the changes in the Affordable Care Act, there are also changes in graduate medical education. Graduate medical education is intimately tied to the safety net hospitals, and your slide shows about 4% of the funding comes from IME. It's been proposed that the IME be cut approximately 50%, and the Institute of Medicine will be initiating a big study on GME. I'd be interested in the panelists' comments about how they think these changes in graduate medical education are going to influence the safety net hospitals.
Billy?
Well, it will impact the safety net hospitals, and we've run across that a great deal in Texas already. And that's one of the reasons why we chose to address it through the waiver. If we're going to build infrastructure, if we're going to build capacity, then redirecting those UPL dollars to something more transparent and being able to bring in additional providers that can share in that. I didn't mention that in the pool of funds that we have available, we expanded from 15 over a five-year period. Had we just stayed with UPL, that would have been about a $15 billion pool. Through this waiver, we have access to $29 billion in the pools. So we're really looking at how we can leverage some of those residency programs to answer some of the underlying access to care issues that we have within the state through the waiver and fund some of those through that process.
Go ahead.
Just a couple of responses to that. I mean, I think it's an excellent question. I think for a couple of observations from my hospital. Number one, we recognize that we are going to need to shift our residency programs to emphasize more the kinds of physicians that we think we need to be training in the future. So we actually are initiating this July 1st an FQHC-based family practice residency program, which is a first that we've done, and I think that that's critically important. That's number one. Number two, many of the residency programs, though, from an ACGME standpoint, need to catch up. So in our particular case, for example, the requirements for pediatrics are so overwhelmingly specialist and inpatient-based, and I can't really provide the necessary clinical experiences for my residents because the reality is my inpatient service in pediatrics has diminished significantly because, A, kids don't get as sick as much anymore, and, B, there's a major children's hospital in the area. And most pediatricians are not going to be inpatient pediatricians. They're going to practice in the community. So the residency programs need to catch up to how we need to train doctors and where we need doctors to be going forward. And I think the last point that I would make, I'm relatively new to healthcare, so I just find some of the history on this interesting. I get paid probably half of what my competitor hospitals get paid in the area to train my residents because of the Byzantine formula that's used to allocate GME dollars. If we're going to be talking about transparency in DISH and transparency in other payments, we need to be talking about transparency in GME funding as well. There's no reason why I get paid $77,000 a resident and my competitor hospitals get paid $150,000 a resident when I do the same exact teaching as my competitor hospitals do, because that does not permit me to fund the educational experience the way that I would need to.
Thank you. Do our pediatrician people up here have anything to add to that? Okay.
I thought about writing about this before. I mean, I agree we need to shift the way we train physicians, not just pediatricians, but broadly. I mean, I think system redesign, quality improvement, et cetera, we have many skills that are team-based practice that are critical for sort of health transformation that historically we haven't taught as well through medical school and the residency process.
Yes, hi, I'm Sean Grimminger with the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm the lead lobbyist, so I'm the person who gets to come up here and, you know, ask for money. And I will assure you that asking for money with nothing in exchange is just as effective in Washington as it is in Albany. To that end, though, we remain deeply concerned about the level of DISH cuts included in the Affordable Care Act. Particularly, I mean, they start actually literally next fiscal year in 2014, but get very, very large as you go into the out years. And we are very concerned that, you know, there'll be far too little DISH, even if it's better targeted, to fund everything that we have to do. Do you think that there is a sort of a deal that can be made in which, you know, we talk about greater transparency in DISH, linking DISH money to, you know, quality outcomes, and, you know, effectively be able to get some of that money back. Understanding the deep fiscal pressures we have here, it's something that we're toying with, the idea of saying, look, we know that Medicaid DSH has a very strange formula and one that's not well understood and one that, frankly, is probably irrational in some ways. You know, can we make a more efficient DSH program with better accountability but actually be able to hold on some of that money?
Can I just ask, in that same connection, could someone in the course of responding to your question put the cuts in a context? We have the numbers of what the cuts are. Off what kind of a base? Is this a 20% cut over 10 years? Is it a 2%
cut? It's a 50% cut over 10 years.
Okay. Anyone want to talk about
I can't speak to whether or not there's a deal to be cut. I think many of you around the room are better position to indicate whether there's a deal to be struck. I think the issue, though, is the DSH cut is premised on the success of the ACA. And if the ACA is successful, completely successful, and we only have 22 or 26 million uninsured, and we agree that that we would like to see the DSH dollars subsidize at least the costs of the uninsured and at least at something approaching the Medicaid rate. That would be my premise. I'm not sure that you would agree with me. Then that's the question. Can we reduce the uninsured sufficiently so that the remaining DSH dollars can in fact cover the cost of the uninsured or most of the cost of the uninsured? Where does Medicare DSH fit into that is an open question as well. But I think we have to acknowledge that there will be remaining uninsured and that through our DSH mechanisms, it is important that particularly the safety net hospitals that are serving the largest numbers. If you have 5 uninsured patients, it's a lot different than if they are 10 or 20% of your patient population, that those dollars need to flow to those hospitals. So there's not a perfect answer, but that's how I look at it.
I mean, I think for those in the room, just to give a sense of the importance of this to a public hospital, my hospital-specific disproportionate share payment last year was something on the order of $85 million. My hospital is a $440 million hospital. So, you know, 50% reductions in disproportionate share payments have a massive impact to a hospital like mine, unless there are the concomitant adjustments that we're talking about. But it's not benign. And I know there's a history, a somewhat sordid history relative to how disproportionate share funds have been used, not so much by the providers, but at state levels, for example. But I think that's frankly been cleaned up in most instances. And so I would urge policymakers to understand the critical nature of this funding and that the kinds of cuts that we are talking about the latter part of this decade, if the Affordable Care Act is sustained, the individual mandate is sustained, and if we proceed along the path that we're currently proceeding, they are large and they have the potential to be radically dislocating unless the insurance levels are concomitantly increased. So careful attention needs to be paid to that, and I would be supportive of where NAPH stands. That the reality is that we, you know, if you're taking care of a lot of Medicaid folks, you're undercompensated relative to the cost of care that you deliver. I know no one wants to talk about it, but the reality is places like mine, for example, we're not going to see much of an impact in the Medicaid increase in Medicaid enrollment because most of the folks who are uninsured that we see are undocumented, and it's just a fact of life. And the reality is that someone has to pay for that.
Hi, my name is John Custer. I'm with Mintz Levin and ML Strategies. My question was for Dr. Conway. It's a little more specific. You mentioned the community care transition grants. I was just curious as to what type of groups are actually applying for these and actually getting accepted. I mean, community care transition can be pretty wide-ranging from everyone who provides out-of-pocket, you know, home health aides and companions for elderly people to short and long-term rehabilitations at, you know, like nursing facilities and things like that. So I was just kind of curious on the transparency of where some of that money was going.
Yeah, and so let me give a general answer, and then afterwards I'm happy to follow up with more specifics. So they are given out to community-based organizations, which was defined reasonably broadly in the RFP relating to this funding. It's been an array of organizations that apply. I think, to be fair, in the beginning parts of the program, there were some challenges matching the RFP and the funding dollars to organizations. And so we've actually done some work working with organizations to try to understand, you know, even having our QIOs work with organizations in their state to help understand the program better, help understand the application process, help understand that sort of partnering with groups in your community is really what we're looking for. So you have sort of coalitions within a community. But happy to talk after if you want more specifics. We can get in touch with the right folks about who all has been awarded, et cetera.
This question's for Billy and for Dr. Conway. And I think we first want to acknowledge, I think I read that Billy's supposed to retire at the end of the month. And I think we all want to acknowledge the leadership role that he's taken on Medicaid issues. And I think we're all going to miss him, but I suspect we'll still see him around D.C. One of the examples of that leadership role is what you discussed, how you're dealing with the supplemental payments under upper payment limits. And I was wondering, Billy, how difficult it was to get that waiver approved, and perhaps Dr. Conway would want to speak on that as well. And to Dr. Conway, are there other ways? Billy pretty much had to take a roundabout way of dealing with the issue. It's a fairly convoluted approach. Is it within CMMI's authority to avoid the waiver and grant states permission to do this directly?
Well, thank you for your kind words. But it's actually the end of August rather than the end of this month. It was a difficult process, no doubt, proving up the need for the waiver with CMS, and probably rightfully so, because they have to be judicious stewards of the program they're charged to manage, and then proving up the need with the OMB. It was an arduous process. I think there are some things that probably if the federal government could do to streamline this process, where once we have done this, maybe make it easier for other states that follow. We spent a lot of time on standard terms and conditions. I have 85 pages of standard terms and conditions, which I think I probably could have gelled this down to probably 20 or 25, much easier. So I think there's CMS has been more than helpful, but I think there's some other things that we can do to administratively simplify this whole waiver process when you look at what states are trying to do, the objectives they're trying to achieve, but still build in that accountability. But again, going back, it was a partnership working with CMS around what we're trying to achieve and then that whole negotiation process. We submitted our waiver in July and negotiated through until it was finally approved on December 12th of 2011. So it was a quick process, but it was time intensive, involving many trips to Washington, D.C. from my home in Austin, Texas.
Hello. My name is Judy Chesser.
Before you go, I just wanted to give Patrick a chance to respond if you'd like.
I'll be brief, and then I know I have Medicaid colleagues in the room if we want more detail on the waiver process. So I think, you know, we certainly, like all our processes, and I think this is a good example, one, we want to look at ways to streamline, to make it still an effective process, but as efficient as possible. We also, from our quality office, we're actually detailing some folks to help with the 1115 waiver process to make sure we have both our quality and payment. We have a good cohort of people to review. We've always had a good cohort of people, but to make sure we have the right skills at all times to review the waivers. And then I think lastly, in terms of CMMI, I don't want to get ahead of Rick Gilfillan and their group, but I think they're certainly thinking about and have talked about as much of this work publicly about sort of state-based innovation as well.
Hello. My name is Judy Chesser. I'm with the New York City Health and Hospital System. We're the largest public hospital in the country, and just to sort of give you some numbers to try to address at some point, we served 1.3 million people last year. 475,000 were uninsured. And given that New York is pretty progressive already and has a very generous Medicaid program as far as eligibility, we don't see a lot of those people getting a lot of change in those numbers with the ACA. We're thrilled that the ACA has passed, don't get me wrong. And we're working with people on trying to come up with more and better and more efficient ways to deliver services. But one thing I would encourage is for CMS and the Innovation Center to focus some more on the Medicaid side of the house, because there's been much more emphasis on Medicare. And I sort of understand that Medicare is federally run and all the data is much more readily available and you don't have to deal with 50 different programs because every state has its own deal. But I would just encourage you to, because when Medicaid gets expanded in 2014, it would be good if you got your arms around it before the expansion. Thank you.
Advice taken, I guess. Let me just say, as we turn to the next questioner, as we go through this Q&A session, I note with approval that a number of you have pulled out the blue evaluation forms, and I would urge you all to do that to give us the feedback that we need to shape, I know it's hard to believe, but perhaps even better programs than this one in the future. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Marissa Wiesel. I'm with the American Heart Association. Dr. Conway, you mentioned the bill that, or the regulations that came out about a year ago about physicians and providers' ability to use telehealth. And I was wondering, from the safety net hospital standpoint, has that kind of been embraced? Have there been any improvements in using telehealth to improve access to rural populations? And if not, you know, what else is needed?
All those rules.
Yeah, as I say, we don't have a lot of farms. But I will say this, that we have not, to the level that I would like, really integrated telehealth into our programming. I think that has to come. It's going to come soon, and it's certainly going to be, you know, we're discussing design some expansion sites for outpatient primary care, and that's something that we want to do, particularly for psychiatric consultations, for et cetera, and other specialty consultations. So it's definitely part of our plan. It's not something that we have really embraced at the level that I would like to have, but I'm not representative. In other words, you know, for you're talking more about areas where getting to the specialist is a couple hundred mile trek, which is here we have specialists falling all over one another in my neck of the woods. So I don't know that I'm the best person to address that, but it is definitely part of what has to be. It has to be part of every safety net hospital strategy going forward. It's the future.
Billy Mill, I'm told there are rural areas in Texas.
There are a few. It was curious when we developed our delivery system reform incentive payment menu, that wasn't an issue in Harris County, where you have Houston and you have just a wealth of resources, but it was in some of our rural areas. And so that's why we allow partnerships to address telehealth, and also focus on the primary patient-centered medical home, where it may not be access to a specialist, but building the capacity of the primary patient-centered medical home by having access to that specialist. So that's being addressed in our DSRIP menu. But again, it came out of some areas, the rural areas, more so than the urban areas.
Hi, my name is Carol Backstrom, and I'm a senior advisor in the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services, so I'm with CMS. And I just wanted to reemphasize part of what Dr. Conway was talking about in terms of some of the pathways and work that we're doing in the Center for Medicaid and working with states. So unlike the Affordable Care Act, where they really lay out, you know, sort of the parameters for a Medicare ACO-like model, it's very much a reality that in Medicaid it can't be a one-size-fits-all all kind of approach because each state is different. But also it allows us, in other words, there are good sides and bad sides to that. In one sense, it'd be great to have more formal parameters. On the other hand, we really need to take a state-by-state approach for the different populations within Medicaid and the uniqueness of the Medicaid population. So to that end, we are aware that we need to be a lot more proactive around guidance and helping states think through some of these issues. And we're in the process of releasing some guidance in the form of state Medicaid director letters that will help define the different pathways that states can take, whether it's a state plan amendment or a waiver. I think highlighting the Texas waiver as well as the California waiver, that's one example of a tool in the toolbox of doing something different under Medicaid reform and payment reform, but that's only one tool. So there's a lot of other existing ways that we can think about this with Medicaid populations, and so we stay tuned to hear more from CMS on that front.
Very good. Dr. Riley, you've been compiling questions here.
Yes.
They've come forward.
Okay. So could the speakers comment on the potential role that private equity can play as a potential source of capital for safety net hospitals? Is it currently being used, and if so, to what extent, and what are some of the drawbacks of doing that?
There are examples in the country where private equity has been tapped by safety net facilities in order to enhance access to capital. Let me take a step back and say, you know, particularly in New York, safety net facilities, whether public or not for profit, have an incredibly limited ability to access capital. And so you have sort of a bimodal distribution where you have these facilities that have essentially limited or no access other than through the government to capital resources, and then you have institutions that are running $1 billion multi-year capital campaigns, and that creates a huge disconnect in the delivery system in New York between really the haves and the have-nots, and that actually led to an inclusion by a major figure in New York, in a report on the hospitals in one of the boroughs in New York City. I think he had one sentence where he talked about the possible reintroduction of for-profit healthcare hospitals in New York, which is a major source of controversy because of the potential conflict between the need to maximize shareholder value in a for-profit company and the mission that the not-for-profits and the publics have to serve the underserved. But that being said, I think that we have to have a robust discussion about how we can connect up private equity and safety net facilities, because the governments just simply are not going to have the capital resources to allow these types of facilities to make the kinds of improvements that are going to be necessary. That would be number one. And number two, I would encourage safety net facilities to be creative in how to tap private sources of capital. So, for example, my hospital has about 80 acres of developable real estate. I don't intend to spend a dime developing that real estate because I don't have a dime to spend developing that real estate. But what I am going to do is attempt to encourage private investment in ways that synergize and support what it is that we're doing. So whether it's private investment in outpatient services or private investment in senior living or assisted care, or whether it's private investment in academic facilities, that investment will ultimately inure to the benefit of the patients that I serve, and it's a way of leveraging private dollars to help serve the public good. And I think we have to be open to that and be creative in how we do that and still be true to our mission.
Deborah, have you run into that in other states?
No, I haven't. And to the extent we've discussed this a great deal in New York, I think the tension is what Art alluded to, which is private equity wants a return. So how do you balance their need for a return on the investment with the mission of a safety net hospital? And if there's ways to do it outside of the creative notions that Art put forward, which are a win-win, It's not that often that you can meet both of those needs, the need for a return and the need to maintain mission. And I think that's the challenge, and I think that's part of the controversy that the one sentence in the report Art alluded to, engendered in New York among the safety net community and more generally among our not-for-profit hospitals.
Yeah.
So could the panelists say a little bit more about the role of safety net hospitals in caring for undocumented immigrants? Specifically, what is the obligation to care for the undocumented population, and how will the Affordable Care Act impact the ability of safety net providers to provide this care?
Well, I think, first of all, there's EMTALA. So when a patient comes into the emergency room, whether they're documented or undocumented, the hospital has to take care of them and stabilize them, and that includes admitting them and taking care of them in the hospital until they're stabilized. And then the challenge is, once they're stabilized, you can't discharge a patient to the street, and if they're undocumented, no nursing home will take them, and if they can't go home, there's a continuing problem. So everybody has alluded to this. Undocumented immigrants will not have access to coverage under the ACA, and that for hospitals in states like New York and I suspect Texas and California and several others, a large percentage of the uninsured are undocumented, and the DSH dollars then are a critical revenue stream. One thing that Medicaid does that's very important is that Medicaid will cover the emergency costs of undocumented immigrants up to the state's eligibility level, which in 2014 will be 133% of the federal poverty level. So Medicaid is an important revenue stream in two respects. One, it covers the emergency costs of undocumented immigrants, and two, it provides for Medicaid DSH, and that is absolutely critical because whether the patient's a citizen or undocumented, the hospital incurs costs of treating them.
We had a couple of questions about the 340B program, which is the federal program which provides low-cost medications to safety net patients. How have states expanded the use of the 340B program to assist safety net hospitals in raising revenues or in containing their costs for medications?
Level.
Go ahead. All right. Well, again, I can speak to this at a hospital level. The 340B program is one of really four tools that we use to provide low-cost medicine to our low-income populations. So we use a 340B program, which is a Medicaid program. We have an indigent drug program where we partner with a number of the major pharmaceutical companies to provide us either low cost or free medicine in certain circumstances. So, for example, if we're taking care of somebody who's uninsured and who has cancer and needs chemotherapy, we can also oftentimes get those drugs donated or given to us at a significant discount. We use a product called Sample MD. Those of you who are familiar, in the old days, you used to go to a doctor's office. If they had samples lying around, they give you samples for a week or whatever, and you'd take them away. Now there's all sorts of issues with doing that, regulatory issues with doing that. So there's a company that we work with where the physician can literally, off his or her desktop, print out a coupon, which you would then take to a drugstore, and that would provide you the equivalent of a sample. So the sample's not, it's a virtual sample. The sample's not in the office. You would go get the sample at the drugstore. And the last thing that I would say is that one of the best programs that's out there is actually the Walmart program, which is essentially the $4 program. Because oftentimes even the 340B program can't beat that. And so what we've done is I've had our director of pharmacy services provide our physicians, inpatient and outpatient, with a big chart. And the chart talks to the most commonly prescribed drugs and then how best to, where to direct the patient to get them most inexpensively in order to try to improve medication compliance, because ultimately that's going to inure both to the patient's benefit and to the hospital's benefit in terms of quality improvement. So that's what we've tried to do. It's our view that this is a critical 340B and these other programs are critical if you're really going to get at things like readmissions. Because, you know, the two drivers of a readmission are a failure of a patient after discharge to get follow-up care and a failure of a patient to take his or her drugs. And that failure to take his or her drugs can be an affordability question or it can be a reconciliation question. This helps to focus on the affordability question. So those tools are necessary for us to be able to really drive down readmissions in a safety net context.
Could you explain to me what you mean by a reconciliation question?
Well, in other words, you may have patients that are taking 5, 6, 7 meds or taking meds from 2 or 3 prescribing physicians. They may or may not have disclosed that to the hospital. They may or may not have remembered this, and as a result, the medicine that we prescribe may not have the desired effect. And that's where the follow-up care and some sort of external care management is so critical for making sure that that the patient is not only taking the medication, but is taking the correct medication given all the other medications that he or she is taking.
Great, thank you.
Hi, Bob Rohr, BMJ. A number of hospitals have gone about the process of integration by purchasing medical practices, everything from specialty care through down even to general practices. What are safety net hospitals doing, in their version of this? Are they doing, I know they don't have the financial resources to go out and purchase things, but how are they preparing themselves to better provide a full spectrum of integrated care?
Good question.
Some of our competitors, for example, last year, their goal was to acquire 1,000 physician practices. We could not acquire 1,000 physician practices. We wouldn't have the financial wherewithal to do that. However, I think, at least I'll speak for my hospital, I would say it's critically important, though we have an employed physician base, and though the employed physician base has turned from a liability even 5 or 6 years ago to now a significant asset for developing the kinds of alignment strategies that you'd want to develop to provide high-quality, low-cost care, we know that we have to expand our medical perimeter. We know that we have to expand beyond the walls of our hospital and our health centers. So we have to have vehicles to acquire strategically physician practices that would help to support our hospital and diversify the services that we offer and hopefully help to augment our payer mix. So we don't have a lot of money to do that, and we don't have a lot of money to make upfront investments which are going to initially lose money until hopefully they make money. But the reality is you have to compete in that world, because otherwise what's going to happen is that the hospitals that are better endowed financially simply will buy up all of the competitive physician practices and any kind of external referral base will go. So from a competitive positioning standpoint, that's just not something you can permit to happen. We are going to be capital challenged in that regard, so we just have to be smart with the allocation of the resources. Now, again, I don't want to suggest that that's representative of every safety net hospital. They're all going to approach this differently, but I can say that in mine, where I am competing against acquisitive hospital systems, even if just for defensive purposes, I have no choice but to do that. But in reality, what I've tried to do is be smart and strategic about it in order to position. So I'll give you an example. There are a number of mental health providers, outpatient mental health providers in my county who, for a number of different reasons, because of state funding issues, are going to have a real hard time surviving 3 to 5 years in the future. It is also the case that in Nassau, in my county, you don't have much by way of co-location of primary care and mental health services. So my strategy is that we should be looking at these marginal mental health outpatient services that are going to go in the next couple of years, try to see if we can leverage what resources I do have. In this particular case, it's my co-operated federally qualified health center. Try to leverage that as a resource and essentially expand out further into the community and wrap these mental health providers in and co-locate primary care with these mental health providers. I've expanded my medical perimeter. I brought more patients in. This is clearly a vulnerable population, and I've co-located primary care and mental health. So to me, it hits all of my strategic points, and it's something that I need to do. Now, that's an unconventional strategy. That's not a strategy that you know you're sort of more you're my competing systems are going to be going after, but it's a strategy we would pursue. But then I also have to pursue the more conventional strategy of identifying some practices in the area that help to support and augment my hospital and my primary care reach. But again, I just have to be targeted and selective in how I do it.
I just want to make a quick point, which is a little bit off point, but I think the expansion of Medicaid is going to have a tremendous impact on the mental health system or mental health and substance abuse system, because in the vast majority of states, there's only limited behavioral health services being provided today under Medicaid. And with the expansion, with the application of mental health parity to Medicaid, this will change dramatically how mental health is delivered and the demand for it among low-income populations, which, building off of Art's point, is both an opportunity and a challenge and a real need for the safety net delivery system. And a little bit off point, but I think it's something we'll hear increasingly more about.
Okay. Yes, sir. Hi, my name is Saad Kamal. I'm a public policy analyst here. It's a follow-up to the antitrust question. What kind of antitrust clarity are you looking for? So this is specifically to Art, that can help with your strategy and strategy for safety net hospitals. And the second part to that is how much of this consolidation is based on the fact that the Part A schedule under Medicare is more stable than Part B?
In terms of clarity, I meant that as a general point, but I am going to give a specific example. The general point that I was trying to make is that there seems to be an inherent tension between a progressive body of law and of opinions and of approaches by regulatory bodies relative to enhancing and improving competitiveness amongst providers, and the imperatives that I think are implicit or sometimes explicit in the Affordable Care Act and in a number of the payment and delivery system reforms that are in the Affordable Care Act, and that is that you really have got to be integrated and coordinated as providers to make those things work. So I just think, and it's recognized, I mean, I just think that over the course of the next few years, that tension has got to play itself out, and we've got to understand that the greater good here may be an intensive amount of collaboration, which may not necessarily mean increased competitiveness, but it may actually mean better results for patients. So I think that just the tension has to play itself out amongst a body of laws and regulations that have existed, and now the new laws and regulations that have been promulgated under the Affordable Care Act. The specific example I'll give you is, and this will play out, I think, ultimately, and I think it's going to ultimately play out in the Supreme Court. It'll be interesting how it does it. And that's an 11th Circuit decision relative to the use of state action antitrust protection. And in this particular case, it was basically, if I understood it, it was a public authority, and this was without any kind of state imprimatur, but it was as a state public authority, essentially acquired the only other hospital in a particular region. And I believe it was the FTC that indicated that they were concerned about the anti-competitive effects of this. And the view of the 11th Circuit was, well, it's in the statute it says that this public authority could acquire hospitals It must have been understood that they could acquire hospitals whether there were a dozen or whether it was only one. And so then, therefore, the argument that this is somehow violative is wrong and state action has to prevail. Well, that's going to be tested. I mean, that's going to go up the chain. But the federal government is making the case here that that's a problem. And maybe it is a problem, all right, when you get into the details. But I think it's very important that this gets clarified, because I think what's important on the provider level is the providers and states, but really the providers understand what tools are available. In my particular case, state action, antitrust protection, I think is going to be critical. I'm a public authority. My board is appointed by the government. I'm not a membership corporation. I'm not a for-profit corporation. So, you know, ownership becomes an issue. But because I'm essentially a standalone public hospital, my managed care rates are abysmal. And I cannot cross-subsidize losses that I incur from other payers. So I have to figure out a strategy that would allow me as a non-owned or sponsored entity to still be able to be paid, and I'm not suggesting to be paid grossly, I'm saying get paid fairly for the work that I'm doing. And the strategy that we've identified, which is the only strategy that I think is available, is a combination of clinical integration, which is an acknowledged safe harbor, with an overlay of state action antitrust protection, which would essentially allow us as a non-owned entity with a major system in the area to have protected collaboration on quality strategy and managed care. I think that's a good strategy. It's an untested strategy. So we're going in way in uncharted waters on this, but I think it's necessary in order for facilities that can't access capital and can't get the kinds of managed care rates that are necessary to be paid appropriately for the services that we provide to be able to position themselves to be able to do that and still preserve the public entity and still preserve the public mission.
Okay, that actually is a pretty good place to bring this discussion to a close. While you're filling out, those of you who haven't done it already, your evaluation forms, let me just say the Commonwealth Fund and Dr. Pam Riley have made a substantial contribution to the success of this conversation. I want to thank them. I want to thank you for staying with a very complicated set of topics within the general topic, and ask you to help me thank the panelists for grappling with and subduing, for the most part, a whole range of questions in this area. Thank you very much.